Hi, it's Bo Dewar again. Hope you enjoyed part one of the interview. You must have, because you're here for part two, which starts right now.
The cost of youth soccer, the industry, has just gotten completely out of control.
Why are kids on certain teams and how have they found themselves there? And is it indeed the best situation for them to develop?
There really seems to be a lack of inclusion.
I'd love to see a club just be honest and say that.
Right. But you know all that BS? Forget that. We're not saying it because it doesn't matter. We're just going to play to win.
Okay.
Okay.
So, we were talking about field sizes.
And I was just telling you about that kid. Once he caught up, he was the best kid in the whole group. But it took him years to kind of overcome the conditions under which we play. The field size and the grass itself. I would argue that our little kids should be learning the game on blacktop. And people will look at me and say, well, but that's not soccer. Parents will never go for that. That's dangerous. Well, we play basketball on blacktop. At least we did when I was a kid. We used to play touch football on blacktop. Well, soccer, they might trip and hurt themselves. Well, not if they're playing on blacktop. They'll figure it out very quickly. In Spain, Argentina, Italy, et cetera, or France, just won the World Cup, with a great number of players who have done nothing, or as kids did nothing but play on concrete, they're all still alive. You play differently when you play under those conditions. The game also becomes less physical and more skill-based, especially at those early ages, if you're playing on hard, fast surfaces. So when we play on the kinds of surfaces and the field sizes that we play on in this country, we're going to reward the wrong things.
Right. Now, the messy kid that I mentioned, that was back when, I suppose it's fairly typical in our club, sort of the older you get, the better choice of field you have. So when you're practicing on, these practices would have been an elementary school field where, the grass was probably pretty long. And then I practiced on a park where I went out for the first practice of the fall and I realized that they had not watered the field all summer, and sure enough, within about 2 weeks of 5 days of practice and 1 day of game time on this field, it's all torn up. And then they came out and aerated it, so we were playing basically on clumps of dirt. I suppose it's sort of like playing on gravel.
I don't know if you read that New York Times piece before the World Cup about the French national team, about Mbappe and these other players who grew up playing in the banlieues. And it talks about this one kind of elite team, kind of U14s, U15s, right before a big game. The coach takes them to go play on one of the dirt fields that they grew up playing on, because he said it's going to sharpen, it's going to get them sharp and ready for this big game, because on the dirt, you're going to have bumps and divots. You're not going to be able to control, you're going to have to work that much harder to control the ball. I mean, there's real value in playing in garbage situations. I mean, in our book, in our chapter called No Space, so we have a chapter, No Grass, talking about, our obsession with playing on grass. But we've got another chapter, No Space, where we talk about the different spaces that people play soccer on around the world. One of the most fascinating games of soccer I've seen was played on a terraced plaza in front of the Reina Sofia Contemporary Art Museum in Madrid, Spain. So we've got this kind of stair-stepped plaza. And these kids are playing soccer on stair steps with tourists walking through the game and old folks sitting around, milling around the game. And the kids, they're not playing a soft, wimpy game. They're blasting this ball full speed around this plaza, not hitting the tourists, not hitting the old folks, and on a surface that is stair stepped. What kind of skill do you have to play under those conditions, to survive in those conditions? Or in Italy, playing in this little kind of half moon plaza in front of an old Baroque church. They're playing on kind of this marble surface around a fountain, but they were playing a real soccer game. The skills that you have to develop to manage a ball under those kinds of conditions. I don't know how you recreate that, but we could certainly at least get ourselves off the thick grass, get ourselves off the big fields. And for these little kids, I would say up through U12 for most kids, most of the time they should be playing on very small fields, very fast surfaces. And then we'll create, we'll be producing a sea of highly skilled players that then you can start to teach Barcelona style to. And they will have all the technique and all the creativity and all the game sense that you could ever wish for. Then you begin to mold that talent into kind of a professional soccer player. Right now we're trying to mold professional soccer players out of kids who've just kind of learned to boot the ball and always make the safe pass, always make the right pass, which is another thing you hear from even the very best coaches, watching games around the United States. They're joysticking their kids to pass. You always have two or three passes in the final third. And of course, two or three passes in the final third are going to score those goals, at the younger age groups. But our kids just need to be left alone to figure out for themselves, to try to nutmeg the keeper, so to speak.
Yeah. I would say if I'm on an aerated or gravelly or bumpy field, my inclination would be to blast the ball so it's not on the ground. But on a fast flat surface, and here's the funny thing where we run into sort of the conventional wisdom, which is that there's definitely a backlash these days against artificial turf. And as you mentioned, I mean, the ideal surface would be to have short grass. That's just very difficult to maintain if you're going to have, you know, 5 hours of practice each day and then, 8 hours of games every weekend. But then artificial turf really is kind of the next best thing.
Yeah.
In terms of throwing the ball. And it's just we're worried about for injuries and so forth. But I think a lot of people get confused about what the best surface is for a U7 kid who's just learning how to play versus the best surface for, say, a Women's World Cup game.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, our concern with injuries, you know, a lot of those injuries aren't going to happen if we just leave the kids alone and let them play. You know, instead we're overcoaching, and then we go to these tournaments, and it's intense game after intense game after intense game after intense game. What we need more play, but we need more low-key play. The kids just having fun. Kids get injured at tournaments. Kids don't get injured when they're just playing soccer. You know, maybe it's just anecdotal, but everything I've seen, the concussions that I've seen, the career-ending concussions I've seen, have all happened in the third and fourth games of tournaments. They haven't happened even in league play, but they certainly don't happen when kids are just fiddling around with the ball. You don't get kids concussed in those situations. So, you know, these overuse injuries, our concern with injuries, again, we are putting the cart before the horse. We're acting as if these kids are professionals before they even learn to just play the game. And if we just leave these kids alone to play the game, around age 12, age 13, that's when kids figure out what they really want to do anyways. You'd have a whole nation full of really talented, creative kids, and then you begin to select. And then you're selecting from a much broader swath of talent. And even if you want to select at a younger age, I mean, I'm not delusional. We're dealing with the system that we're dealing with. You can't just, if I were the czar of U.S. soccer, maybe I would just change everything overnight, but that's not going to happen. But, you know, even if you're going to select younger, you've got to, once you select, you've got to let them continue to just play. At those younger ages.
Yeah, we'll put you in charge of something in the last couple of questions. Not U.S. soccer as a whole, because that's difficult to do. But and also what I hear from people from in a lot of different youth capacities is we'd like for U.S. soccer to provide a framework, but we don't want someone in Chicago dictating what I'm doing in practice in Des Moines or in Los Angeles or in New Jersey. It's funny. There was one thing about injuries and so forth. There was one thing in the book that made me cringe, because I think I read it right after I was trying to demonstrate something to a player in practice, and I was going up against the kid who has he tends to be a little rough, and so I came out with a bruise on my shin.
Yeah.
Immediately thought, boy, this no shin guards thing, I'm not sure I'm down with that.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, we're not just making this stuff up. What I noticed years ago is that no one ever wears shin guards at practice in Spain, and no one ever wears shin guards at practice in Argentina. And if you play soccer, you know, when I go play soccer with the North American adults in the adult leagues in my hometown or my home region, all the North American men are wearing shin guards. You go play soccer with the Africans or the Mexicans, nobody's wearing shin guards. Now, you know, you have to scratch your head and say, okay, what's going on here? Okay, so Spain's won the World Cup, and of course, my co-author grew up and spent many years of his life in Italy. Nobody wears shin guards over there. You only wear shin guards at the highest levels when you are competing intensely. So how do they get away with this? Well, people would never go for it because you'd hurt each other. Well, as I write about in the book, we decided to try that this year with our U9s and U10s. Now, with U9s and U10s, you still have got some crazy kids, and we're in a small club, so it's not like we're able to select out the crazies. We've got a couple kids who are just a little bit nuts. Got some nice skills, but they're a little bit nuts. I told them, and I told their parents, we're removing our shin guards. Parents looked at me like, okay. And then we had the first day of practice, and even though the parents had agreed, most of the kids showed up with shin guards. I said, kids, look at these two. They're not wearing shin guards. What are we going to do? Talk to them about it. They all took their shin guards off except for one kid. Refused to do it. I didn't force them to take them off. I explained to them how it was going to affect the game. Well, about 5 minutes later, some kid goes slamming into another kid, you know, full speed as if they're wearing shin guards, and, oh, they're on the ground. They're writhing around in pain. Well, we paused. We had a talk. And slowly but surely, things cleaned up. And we went an entire year. And, yeah, there were a few more bruises than there would have been otherwise. But the game got so much cleaner, less beating on each other, and much more skills. It ends up rewarding the skilled players. The skilled players are able to dribble through kids because they're not being kicked. They're not being hacked constantly. They're, at a certain point, is it good to become a solid, tough defender? Absolutely. But at these younger ages, we're trying to teach kids to love the game. They're not wearing shin guards and beating each other to death in the villages of Argentina or in the favelas of Brazil. Those kids are tough. They're a lot tougher than our kids. But they're not beating the tar out of each other when they're playing soccer. And none of them are wearing shin guards. They're playing a game that is about skill. And it's like when you're growing up playing football. You're playing touch football with your friends in the street. You don't need to tackle someone to learn the skills of a football player, to learn to juke another player, to learn to make a throw and make a catch. These are the skills that we need to be teaching. So we pulled it off for a year. When we went indoors, it became much easier, and nobody was getting hurt. All winter long, we were playing barefoot, no shin guards, and it was fantastic. We moved back outside, and the adjustment, suddenly the first couple weeks, it was brutal. And I was talking with my assistant coach, and I said, you know, should we go back to the shin guards because kids are getting hurt? And I thought, you know what? I think it's just the adjustment from playing indoors when everything you did worked to going outdoors where suddenly there are divots and so we're running into each other. By the end of it, after a couple weeks of the season, we kept the shin guards off, and the kids were okay. A couple times during the season, I had some parents come to me and say, hey, my kid's shin is really bruised. Can he wear shin guards today? No problem. So we never forced the kids to do it. But, you know, to me, it's not as important as no grass, or, you know, as playing on hard, fast surfaces. If we're trying to create players that have the same skill level as Paul Pogba and Mbappe and Isco in Spain or Messi in Argentina, we should be looking at what the kids are doing there and replicating that. And nobody's wearing shin guards, so go figure.
Did you have any cases where there were kids, and I think, again, of My Little Messi, who would be more timid in those situations and so maybe less likely to get the ball?
Well, I have a couple of really, I have this one really small kid, really small. he just, absolutely ran free. And no, I, you know, all different sides. I've got a couple of really big kids, some really small kids. I mean, it's just your typical U9, U10 age group. And not at all. The field is small enough that we're playing on most of the time that everyone's going to get touches. Everyone's going to get their touches in. And I simply didn't run into those problems. I mean, there were a lot of problems that you would think would happen. But again, it's you when you just let them play under the conditions that they would typically choose to play under if they were just kids in the street, the game teaches itself. I mean, if there's a reason why it became the beautiful game, why it became the world's game, because it's a game that people just kind of played with and were creative with. And that's what we're missing in this country. It's been a game that we've practiced from day one in most regions of the country, most ethnic groups and most classes, most economic classes. You know, 99% in this country have been practicing at being a soccer player for the last 40 years. We haven't been just playing soccer.
Now, near the end of Shula Soccer, you say that the grassroots proposals in this book require nothing more than a bit of humility. That seems difficult to me, just because I haven't spent as much time overseas as you have. I've traveled a little bit. In fact, I did just last Thanksgiving. I hiked up to one of the highest points in Barcelona, and there immediately below me, was a futsal court, and I saw some older guys come out and play. In fact, it looked like the kind of game that I wish I could find, where the guys aren't moving very much.
Just kicking a ball around, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I keep hearing those games exist, and I haven't really found them. I played in our local parents' league at one point, and after 5 or 10 minutes of trying to sprint with, Mr. Triathlete, I'm just like, I'm done. Take me out. Humility is not something Americans tend to do. So how do you – in fact, even, not to put you on the spot, but the book itself is not humble in places. I mean, it's given as a guidebook to winning the World Cup. How can we reconcile that?
Well, we're not proposing any simple quick fix. But we're simply saying, if we ever want to win the World Cup, we've got to completely rethink what we're doing, because we're just producing a bunch of automatons, but we're just not producing people with real game sense. For the size of the country we have and the number of kids playing soccer, it's just not working. So, when we say win the World Cup, it's not like we have some magic formula, because our focus is on the grassroots. What happens at the elite levels? I trust that those people know what they're doing, but I think that too many of them do not actually know what's happening with the millions of kids who are signing up at the grassroots and who are leaving before they ever get a hold of them. They're getting a hold of such a self-selecting group of kids who are either economically able and their parents are willing to make all the sacrifices, do all the driving that's necessary. That's such a small little sliver of the kids who are playing soccer, and it is not representative of the talent that's out there. I guarantee you that, having spent many, many years at the grassroots level, there are a lot of really quality kids who are not moving up the system because the parents refuse to do it, or the parents can't afford to do it. And there are no scouts who are actually out there finding the best players. The clubs are simply advertising how wonderful they are. But your question is, going back to your question, I've gotten off, but you're asking
humility.
It requires more than just humility, right? More than just humility.
Yeah.
You're right. In the book, we kind of take a kind of sometimes a little bit of a sarcastic attitude because of what we've seen over the years. We've seen that there's not a lot of humility. First of all, let me say, there are a lot of outstanding people who have dedicated their lives to this, and sometimes it is also their livelihood. And I don't want to say that they shouldn't be making money off the sport and any of that. I'll also say there are some people out there. I think a lot of people who are running these tournaments who are simply in it for the buck, and they don't care one lick about the development of the players. And there are clubs out there who are like that. But I think for the most part, a lot of really well-meaning people. But there's a lot of economic interest in just keeping things the way they are. I'll just leave it at that because I don't want to get into the whole soccer industrial complex. Yes, we have a chapter on that, but that's complicated stuff. And you and probably some of your listeners know more about the higher level, the upper levels of soccer than I do. I know rec soccer and I know the beginning levels of travel soccer and I know that it's not working there. What I will say though is that I believe that there is a way to make money and do things right. The only humility required is to recognize that what we're doing right now isn't working. That despite the fantastic training I received from NSCAA in the NSCAA license courses and the U.S. soccer license courses, coaches courses, they were teaching me to do things that haven't worked. They're giving me the best practices within a system that just isn't working. So we simply need to have the humility to step back and say, our kids at the basic levels we're not developing soccer players. They're not playing soccer. And what I've found is the typical response to anything we've written so far is a lot of people saying, yeah, but what you guys are proposing is not soccer. And I would argue they're begging the question because our question is, well, what is soccer? And I think in this country, we're just so obsessed with this idea that we know what soccer is. And we need to step out of our little bubble, have the humility to step out of our bubble and see that the kids overseas in these soccer mad countries that are producing quality are not playing under the conditions that our kids are playing under. They look like there's almost no comparison. It just doesn't look like the same thing. We're training soccer players. They're playing soccer. And we're training soccer players to play a certain kind of game as if there's only one way to play soccer. And that's kind of what is played on professional fields. So the humility, we're not asking for a whole lot. I'm not totally satisfied with that answer, but now you're getting the complicated, you know, how to actually pull this off. And I recognize there's quite a system that we're facing and there's a lot of money involved. And to have the courage to break out of what is right now paying your mortgage or making your car payment is tough stuff.
Yeah, and the soccer industrial complex is a great phrase, and I've used it before, seen it a few places too. And also, when you go to an NSCAA, what's now United Soccer Coaches Convention, go to the exhibit hall, you go, my goodness, you're charging this much money for this. But there's a funny thing about humility and about learning from overseas and so forth, where U.S. Soccer, the federation, does go out and try to learn, what other countries are doing, but it is mostly at the institutional level.
It's not really always the grassroots.
Yeah.
It's always, what are we doing at Bradenton? And how does that compare to what they're doing at the Camp Nou or at La Fabrica and at Real Madrid? But again, as I said earlier, we're trying to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, and we may be doing everything right in the purse factory, but we're not bringing in silk. We're bringing in the sow's ear and trying to run it through our purse factory. We're losing our kids at the grassroots level. Our kids are not developing at the grassroots level. Our kids are learning skills, but they're not playing the game. And that's what you don't see. And as I say, great people at the top, or even the full-time soccer people I know well, are really great people, and they've given their lives to this thing. But very few of them pay much attention to what's going on at the grassroots, and then it's not their number one priority. And when you kind of challenge them on it, they take issue, because this is their full-time job. And who am I, just some college professor who's, observed a few things. And, I dedicated the last decade plus of my life, once my day job was over, to coaching kids. But still, who am I to give them advice? And that's where right. the humility comes in, because I think that these professional people have got to recognize that there's something they're missing at this basic level. And the same drills, kind of dumbed down versions of the drills they're running for their professional or semi-pro or college players, applied to 3 through 12 year olds don't work. If the 3 to 12 year olds haven't actually just played the game.
Right. Yeah, and there's a contrast that I would draw. I went to a session at the United Soccer Coaches Convention this past a few months ago, I guess. And it was one of the few sessions I went to that was not a presidential candidate forum, because I was covering that. But it was someone from UEFA talking about grassroots initiatives in Europe. And it was all about how, okay, we're going to talk with – clubs, and we don't just mean Barcelona or Ajax or Bayern Munich. We mean a neighborhood club, about, you know, what programs you're doing. Now, contrast that with discussions I've had in the U.S. with people who, when you talk about any of this stuff, they say, well, that's a recreational mindset. You know, that's what comes up again. And what I end up saying back to these people is, look, every single player, whether they're going out and playing in their neighborhoods in Spain or Argentina, or whether their first experience is being a five-year-old playing for AYSO, every single player starts as a recreational player.
Exactly.
And
you are absolutely,
and we don't see that here.
Yeah.
We just don't see it here. So,
soccer is a game. Games are recreation. It always begins with a recreational mindset. Every kid, Messi began with a recreational mindset. Pele began with a recreational mindset. Mbappe began with a recreational mindset. It is play. And if our kids don't ever play, then there's going to be no foundation upon which to build. And that's what we see. We see, you know, I read an article years ago, and as we talked earlier, there are all sorts of people in U.S. soccer who are saying the right thing, but then they never complete the argument. So there's an article called "We Want Robinho's Not Rolas." Of course, that's when Robinho was the newest revelation at Real Madrid back in 2006. Didn't exactly pan out, but he did have a spectacular debut for Real Madrid. I think they were playing Malaga back in the day. "We Want Robinho's Not Rolas." And he points out, you know, that we're developing robots in this country. Well, 12 years later, 12 years after the article was written, nothing has changed.
We still are.
We're still producing robots and not Robinhos, because you can write all the articles in the world, but unless you acknowledge the system that is designed to create robots, a system that is designed around winning. Now we're talking about the bigger picture, the soccer industrial complex, a system that where the rewards are for winning and not for developing players. And as long as we have that, perhaps it's too much to ask people to just change everything overnight. Although I do think some of the conditions we talk about in our book could be changed right now and produce immediate victories. But the overcoaching of our kids, we have got to change the reward system. The U.S. soccer has got to figure out some way to begin to reward, direct rewards to coaches for developing players at the youngest ages, direct rewards for developing players and moving them along the pipeline, so that people can see and people can brag about, not just, you know, you have the clubs who will brag about the number of players or who are playing Division One or who are playing college soccer. You know, but that's, you know, that's 15 years sometimes after they began playing. 15 years later, you put on your website. But, you know, in Spain, and I know the system is different, but in Europe, you know, my son played with a six-year-old who the next year was scouted while he was playing alongside my son, and the kid went to Real Madrid's academy the next year. So, you know, the local club that my son played with was able to say, hey, Benjamin is at Real Madrid this year. I know our system, it's different, but you've got to create – somehow we've got to create incentives, some way of creating immediate rewards for coaches who develop players, and ways of making clear when you've got coaches who are not developing players. We've got to be able to see that, because – that your average American parent cannot see that, and even the clubs themselves aren't interested in seeing it. I mean, I can name you coaches who know how to win games, but they don't develop their players. Their players stagnate. Their players are booting long, hard shots and chasing after balls from the time they're 6 years old to the time they're 12, 13, and 14. And by the time they're 12, 13, and 14, they have no skills. They can still boot a ball really hard, You know, and maybe that worked for the American system 20 years ago, but those kids aren't developing. But the coaches are continuing to be rewarded because the coaches win. You can win through the youth ranks by booting the ball hard and chasing hard and being intense. Those kinds of things. And now we're talking really big. But U.S. soccer has got to figure out some way to disincentivize that kind of behavior and to reward the coaches who are developing talent.
Okay, so I'm going to combine the two open-ended questions that I had to close with.
Okay.
And they were putting you in charge at a couple of different points in the U.S. soccer community. The first one I had in mind was kind of a mid-sized club, let's say at a typical age group, you know, U12, U14. They have maybe four travel teams and 12, 16 recreational teams. The other one was, let's say you're in charge of a regional pyramid. The one that I know in my area is EDP, which has, its top division, those teams can compete for national titles, and then it goes down to lower divisions to where it might be the lower, the C teams of the big clubs and the A teams of the smaller clubs. So if you could be in charge of in both of those capacities, what would you want to accomplish?
This is a tough question because, again, what we're arguing runs so counter to so many of the things that almost any club in this day and age, in this country, even at the lower levels, needs to do to win the respect of its parents. But if I could be in charge of the region I just came from, where the region's large enough that that people would have to travel way out of their way to escape the tyranny of Nathan Richardson. what I would implement is, from the very beginning, our youngest kids are no longer going to be showing up for the first day of soccer out at the grassy field that we've invested so much money in. They're going to be showing up right after school on the blacktop behind their local elementary school. And we're going to run, and they're going to just play soccer, small-sided games. They're going to meet, if we practice twice a week, if we practice once a week, they're going to gather and they're going to play a game. And there's going to be somebody out there, an older kid or an adult with some skills, who's going to get out there and play with them. And they're just going to play soccer. And we're going to continue to do that. So it's going to be small-sided stuff. Just play, 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 play. When something goes wrong, you pause, you point something out, and you move on. On Saturday mornings, we're going to gather. We're not going to there aren't going to be uniforms. We're going to put a penny on them. We're not going to require anything other than a pair of tennis shoes. And we're not going to have a referee. We're not going to have necessarily coaches. We're going to simply have a facilitator out there, and the kids are going to play. And that's what we're going to do for at least through, let's say, age 10. I would prefer age 12. As they get older, the size of the field we play on will be get a little bit larger. We're never going to play more than maybe a 6v6 or 7v7 at most. At a certain point, you shove in the goalies, but we're going to keep the uniforms off the kids. We're going to keep the referees out of things. And what you're going to discover is a bunch of kids just playing a game, having a good time. People aren't going to be worrying about keeping scores. You're going to have fewer injuries. And by age 12, we're going to have a bunch of kids with some crazy foot skills. As I say, this is completely off the wall. But I think that's what if you want to develop talent, that's what you're going to do. If we're not going to go that off the wall, we're not going to travel outside of our immediate region. Nobody's going to ever travel further than an hour away for any kind of game. But through age 10, you're not going to leave your city. There's no reason to leave your city, even for the best kids. If it's a small, compact game, if that kid's too good to play with the younger kids, he'll go play with the older kids, or she'll go play with the older kids. And they're not going to get hurt because we're not going to be playing with shin guards. We're going to be playing on blacktop. It's going to be a skills game. It's not going to be a physical game. And we don't have referees out there. We don't have coaches. We don't have uniforms. And so the intensity level the pressure to win is going to drop. It's going to be something you're not going to recognize without all the trappings of an official game. The parents are going to be much more chill. The grandparents much more chill. Everyone's going to be sitting there enjoying a game. So I've seen it happen. I lost my train of thought here, but we're not going. Yeah, even maybe age 12 to 14, maybe you can travel up to an hour away. We're not going to do tournaments. We're not going to do tournaments. If we're going to do a tournament, it's going to, again, be just a local thing in the city. We might, and we're not going to be wearing uniforms, just throwing on a penny. Again, get rid of the coaches. We've got facilitators. Tournaments, I think, are the worst thing. And you talk to, again, in the coaching clinics and in the articles you read, you have people acknowledging what a mess tournaments are, but they just keep happening for purely economic reasons. And by the way, they're now starting to take over in Spain and Italy, the two areas that we know from the book. The money is entering into those into those countries now. Tournaments used to be an optional opportunity for kids who weren't going on winter break or going on the very sacred Holy Week in Spain. There would be maybe a Holy Week tournament for the kids who are sticking around. You might bring in ringers from other clubs. That's the only time you have tournaments. Tournaments are not part of a season. The season is you play every Saturday for 9 months, except for these breaks, and then you have the optional tournament. Get rid of all the tournaments. Get rid of the travel. Right now, we talk about in the book, we've got three elite boys programs in Northwest Ohio. Three elite boys programs. I know the kids who play on the U14 teams for all three of those programs. They all play in separate leagues. One travels up into Michigan. One travels over into Pennsylvania and even New York, east of Cleveland, and then the other plays in all of northern Ohio. They never play each other. Mm-hmm. Why is that? They would all be able to compete with each other. We played in a local state cup. Every team we played in a different league. We had great competition with them, and they're all local teams. Not all of them exactly Northwest Ohio, but they're all fairly local teams. We could be having great competition, never traveling. This is U14. It's never traveling more than a couple hours away. All you need is five teams, and you play each other two or three times. You'd get great competition. But instead, one of these clubs is traveling from Northern Ohio. They're traveling to Virginia, to Tennessee, to Indiana, to New York, week after week. They played our team, which just stays in Northern Ohio. And it was a two, the game ended 2-1. It was a fantastic competition. Why in the world, if I were in charge, we would not be traveling. We would not be traveling. There was some coach that you quoted in your blog recently where he said, anybody who proposes a national championship for kids, ought to be shot or something, And I think he's
it's the old quote from Horace Bertle, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane if you think about it. Why in the world? Why in the world are kids in any sport competing in national championships at age 12 or 13 or even 14? I don't care about your national skills until you're college age. Who cares? We're all developing. We're all still figuring things out. If I were the czar of U.S. soccer, you play in your region. There's plenty of talent out there, but I do suspect that there are some people who are interested in leaving the competition behind. They don't want to face the local competition. They want to create elite conditions so that their kid can be one of those elite. We'd rather be a big fish in a small pond and eventually flame out. But to have the bragging rights while we're raising our kid is more important than producing true overall excellence. And I'm not saying anything new there. I mean, we know that that's the case, not just in soccer, but sports all around. We'd rather keep the kids out than bring the kids in. But we would simply say you're not going to travel. We don't travel. We keep it local. Lots of games on the local level and small sided and playing on the blacktop behind the school. I'll just point out that tennis at the highest level is also played on grass. But as you said about replicating the conditions at the Camp Nou, for example, at Barcelona's Camp Nou, you can't replicate the conditions at Wimbledon. But tennis people have understood this from the beginning. Nobody tries to create a grass court at their local high school or at the local parks and rec facility. we play, we create a hard surface that can replicate the kind of grass they play on at Wimbledon or the kind of clay they play on at the French Open. We don't try to teach tennis on grass. Why in the world are we trying to teach soccer on grass? It's not the beautiful game. It may be the game they invented in England back in the 19th century, but it's not the beautiful game that was reinvented in the ports of Buenos Aires and Montevideo and Rio. Okay, that is a game played on hard surfaces with a ball moving 100 miles an hour and requiring tremendous foot skills to make it happen. And you're not beating people to death to try to get that ball or booting the ball as hard as you can to try to score as fast as you can. So, as long as we continue to think we're playing 19th century soccer and to ignore the conditions that create the beautiful game, we will continue to produce 19th century quality soccer players in this country and not create beautiful soccer players.
But it's okay if we leave our shoes on?
You can leave your shoes on. We call it shoeless simply to acknowledge, to make an extreme point, but also because we ended up doing that with our kids this last winter, and they had the time of their lives controlling that ball. You don't have to teach kids to play futsal when they're playing barefoot. They immediately pick it up. They realize controlling the ball with the sole of your foot. They learn those skills almost. You might point it out to a few of them, but if you have someone out there playing with them, they pick it up. Are there benefits from going shoeless? Watch the movie Pelala, for example. I think there are definitely benefits, mm-hmm. but there are some things that are more important. Some things more important than other things. And none of this is rocket science. None of it costs any money. You can still make your money. I think there are ways within the system that the people who have dedicated their lives and whose livelihood depend on this can continue to make their money. But they just need to all step back and agree that they can make their money a different way. So, we're not trying to take the money out of anybody's wallet. We're simply saying, rethink this thing. Otherwise, you're never going to produce what you think you want to produce. And the numbers are dwindling now. And everyone knows that. That truth has finally been revealed, and that should create some give people some pause. So,
So I'll plug that one of my early podcasts was with my fellow Dookie Gwendolyn Otzenham, who was one of the makers of Pelada. She and her then boyfriend, now husband. And can you tell people the full book title again? And it's available. Everywhere.
It's available on Amazon in paperback or Kindle edition. Kindle edition, we put really inexpensive, about as inexpensive as Amazon will let us put it. So this isn't about mm-hmm. making money. This is about people just trying to read outside the box. All we want people to do is read outside the box and think, why not? Why couldn't we do this? And especially parents, to go to their local coaches and local people and say, why aren't we doing this? The book is Shoeless Soccer, Fixing the System and Winning the World Cup.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us today.
All right. Well, thanks for having me, and hopefully it makes some impact. I'm really excited to see, you've talked about your interest in really talking about youth soccer in the coming months. And I think it's a conversation that needs to be continued. So, I wish you the best with that, and happy to continue to contribute in any way we can do so. So good luck.
All right. We'll all keep talking.
All right.
And hopefully doing stuff. All right.
All right. Yes, definitely.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
The funny thing about all this is that there were so many questions that I didn't get to. I actually intended to talk a bit about parenting at large in this interview because it gets into the issue of free range versus helicopter parenting. And those are, if you haven't heard those terms before, they're fairly descriptive. Helicopter, you can imagine it's a parent who's always hovering around and wants to be sure everything goes well. Related to the snowplow parent, again, another nice descriptive term, who basically tries to remove any obstacles that would make a child face adversity. And there's a lot of literature to suggest that that is a bad idea. Helicopter parenting is something that I think you try to avoid, but at some places you just can't. There are some times when you have to step in and teach. And then free range parenting is what it says. And it's a bit endangered right now, so people tend to be a bit defensive about it because we're in an era where you can't send your 11-year-old down to the park without people saying you're a bad parent. And of course, if you're my age, you remember going everywhere on your own when you're 8 years old. So that's something that's changed a bit. Free range parenting advocates really want to bring that back. And of course, the Shoeless Soccer book is, as you can guess, more of a free range advocate. Ideally, of course, kids would be going off and playing on their own. And this book kind of makes peace with the fact that that's not going to happen very often, but suggests, well, then let's facilitate. So if you enjoyed the interview, I think you will enjoy the book. It is, there are some editing issues that you may have noticed in my review of the book, but I think those are minor, easily put aside, and I think the points of the book are interesting. I wouldn't say I agree with them 100%. I wouldn't expect every reader to agree with them 100%. I think in some cases there's a bit of hyperbole to try to make a point with a, perhaps an extreme example. But again, I think the points are worth considering. Some of them have been brought up many times in the conversation. Some of them deserve reinforcement. Some of them I thought were fairly unique and certainly worth a read. So we'll be back next week, continuing the series of people with whom I do not agree 100%. Might be about promotion relegation. We'll see. If you haven't read my promotion relegation page yet, please do. Just go to Ranting Soccer Dad and you'll see it across the top menu. It's about 5,000 words, and I figure that's better than arguing about it 280 characters at a time on Twitter, which I'm basically done with. I'll do a couple of tweets just to explain something here and there, but I'm not getting in these long drag-out arguments that only two people are reading. You can understand why, as I get close to age 50, my priorities change a little bit, and arguing the same argument over and over that I've been having since my early 30s is not among my highest priorities. So if you're interested in the argument, please do read that, and please do listen next week. Should be an interesting conversation. Until then, rant on. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to the Ranting Soccer Dad podcast using whatever podcatcher you use to find this in the first place. Could be iTunes, could be Stitcher, or maybe you came in through the blog, which is rantingsoccerdad.com, where you will find all the past podcasts, along with news and analysis from the world of youth soccer and beyond. And yes, you will find the occasional rant about things. You'll also see a link to the Patreon page to support the podcast and blog and all other Ranting Soccer Dad activities. And you'll see merchandise, including the Travel Sucker t-shirt. Until next time, rant on!
The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.